Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Sign up to our loyalty programme and reap the rewards at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
As I used to say on Monty Python, and now for something completely different, I'm delighted to welcome to the show the great John Cleese. Good morning, John.
Good morning. I have to tell you, if I seem a little strange, I've got bad vertigo today. I've had it for some time, and when I got out of bed, I nearly fell over. But if I sit safely in this chair, I think probably I will not die before the end of the interview.
OK, I'd make a few observations there. One, you've always seemed a bit strange. But secondly, I'm glad that... Do you know that what you've just done is kind of an Irish tradition that what? People of a certain age like to do? It's a thing called, I think it was the late Maeve Binchy, the writer, called it the organ recital, where at the beginning... We get the ailments out of the way. Are there any other ailments you'd like to air before we go on? Because we have time.
Yeah, there's several. I mean, I'm largely a collection of replacements now. I have a replacement right knee, a replacement right hip, a replacement left hip. I don't have a tooth of my own in my body anymore. I have lenses where my eyes would be. I have a pacemaker, and I'm thinking of having a penis enlargement. I'm not really myself.
Am I talking to John Cleese, or have you evolved into something else at this point?
As far as I can remember, Brendan. Brendan?
Got me.
No, it's all very nice here. It's not even as cold as people say. And so assume it's nice in Ireland. Is it raining?
It's a bit chilly. But we'll warm them up now.
So what do you want to know about, Brendan? Because you could ask...
Let's see where we go. I thought we'd start with Fawlty Towers, 50 years old this year. And, John, I took our chat today as an excuse to rewatch Fawlty Towers. And I must say, it's still so funny, so good. Like, I laughed out loud, I think, more than I have at anything else recently. And I know that you watched it again to write this new book, Fawlty Towers, Faults and All. How was it for you watching it again? Did you like it?
Yes, I did. I was surprised how good it was, really, because I was assuming that there'd be bits that didn't work so well, but there were very few of those. And it was wonderful to watch great, great performers like Bernie Cribbins and Joan Sanderson. I mean, these are wonderful, wonderful comedy actors. And when I think that we got that together in 5 days rehearsal, I really wonder how we did it. But the answer is because the people working on it were so good.
Yeah, it did seem like you were watching a hand-picked bunch of people. I mean, the ensemble and the guests, all at the top of their game. And you in the middle of it, absolutely on fire. Did you sense at the time you were making something special?
No. I decided I didn't want to go on with Python. A couple of reasons. I thought we were repeating ourselves a lot. And I think the main thing about comedy is it ought to be fresh. It ought to be new, if you can do that, keep that going. The other thing was that my dear old friend Graham Chapman had become a serious alcoholic by that time, and working with him was not easy because he couldn't remember in the afternoon what we'd written in the morning. So I thought, I think I've done enough of this Python now. I've done, nearly 40 shows. So I was invited out to lunch by the guy who used to direct me when I was first on English television. I used to do a show called The Frost Report with Ronnie Barker and Ronnie Corbett. And he said, "What do you want to do?" And I said, "Well, I'd like to do something with my wife." And the BBC, being what it was in those days, which was very good at making comedy shows, he just said to me, "Well, why don't you go back and talk to her and decide what you want to do?" And I went back and I said to Connie, "Let's do something together." And after about 15 minutes, she said, "Well, what about that hotel we stayed in when we went down to Torquay to film for Monty Python?" And I said, "Yeah, great idea." So I rang Jimmy Gilbert up and I said, "We'd like to do something set in a hotel." And Jimmy says, "Right, I'll commission that." And that's how... In the old days when people knew what they were doing, but then John Burt turned the BBC into a bureaucracy and introduced committees. And of course, we've produced very, very little this century that was really, very funny as a result, because bureaucracies are not very good at making comedy.
What was it about the hotel that you stayed in Turkey?
Well, we both stayed there, Connie and I, and all the Pythons, but the Pythons thought the hotel was so awful that they left after a day and went to stay in the Imperial Hotel in Torquay. But I stayed on with Connie, and it was just as well we did, because it gave us so much material. I mean, the man who ran it, Donald Sinclair, he was just wonderfully rude all the time. You know, nothing was too little trouble. And it was extraordinary just to deal with him and to think this is a man who chose to spend his life running a hotel and dealing with guests, and he just doesn't like them. I think he had the British hoteliers' motto, which is, we could run this hotel properly if it wasn't for the guests.
Yeah. The thing about Fawlty Towers, watching it back, though, it's kind of darker than I remember. So we sympathise with Basil because the world seems against him in one way. But actually, when you say that thing about that Donald Sinclair not liking guests, Basil is actually kind of a cauldron of rage, isn't he?
Well, he gets upset about everything. And of course, he starts off each programme, if you look at it, on a relatively even keel, just sniping away at Sybil and receiving return fire. And then things happen to wind him up. And that's where the skill is in the writing, is winding him up, because there's a wonderful phrase, which is, stress makes you stupid. And of course, the more he gets stressed, the more he makes stupid decisions, and the deeper the poo is that he finds himself in, and he then makes another bad decision. It's a basis of a certain type of comedy, which we call farce. And there was a time when the English just loved farce, because farce is a little bit sillier and slightly sort of higher energy than ordinary comedy. And I like that, because I think you can get bigger laughs.
Yeah, and your physicality was central to that too, I think. Another thing I probably didn't really get watching it as a kid was Basil's very British obsession with class permeates it so much. Tell me a bit about your own background and upbringing. Your parents were a mixed marriage class-wise, weren't they?
Well, yes, Brendan. The place was riddled with class. And there were two things that people wanted to do. They wanted to be seen as being a little higher up than they actually were. And the other thing was that they hated anything to do with losing their reputation. So it was a very respectable that I grew up in, quite a kind one and quite a moral one. But everyone wanted to get safely into their graves without ever having been seriously embarrassed. You know, every time someone from Western Supermare was buried, they were sort of thinking to themselves, oh, thank God I got away with that.
I made it. And so where did the drive to make people laugh come from for you then?
That's a very good question, and I don't know why I got into comedy, but I was always looking at things from a slightly different angle, and it always amused me when I was very young that people took things seriously that seemed to me very unimportant. I can even remember when I was about 7 seeing a letter that had arrived through the post, and it was addressed to Mrs. R.F. Cleese. Well, R.F. was my father's initials. And my mother had to explain to me that in those days, she took on her husband's initials. She was M.E. Cleese, but she became Mrs. R.F. Cleese. And I remember thinking, this is completely insane.
Yeah.
I was a feminist at the age of 7.
Yeah, but it takes a certain kind of person to see the absurdity of a situation that everyone else is going along
That's
with.
And maybe, exactly maybe right,
that
Brendan.
Was it, yeah.
The last time I became hysterical with laughter is my wife was watching the coronation. She was lying on the bed with the four cats watching, and she said, "Oh, John, do come in, do come in." And I came in and sat down on the bed next to all the cats just as Prince Charles came in to Westminster Abbey. And I'm not exaggerating, but within 5 or 6 seconds, I was just laughing hysterically. I just thought, this is a Monty Python script. They're all in silly costumes and all taking it seriously as if something important was happening. And I laughed and I laughed and I laughed. And that's why I've never really been trusted by the important people. They always know that I don't take it seriously, and they want to take it seriously, because when it isn't taken seriously, they feel less important. And pompous people are very frightened of funny, because it's very difficult to maintain the feeling that you're, what's the word, superior to other people.
Like, look at the one species of person that really gets under Donald Trump's skin, and that in a way really kind of threatens him, is comedians, sure. Isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. People who actually laugh at him. And that's right. I have to tell you this, Brendan. Last time I was in Ireland, this is what I love, the Irish. I flew into Dublin, and somebody greeted me and took me to meet the driver who was going to drive me to the hotel. I can't remember which show I was doing. And when I met him, I shook him by the hand and I said, "I understand you have an alcohol problem." And without missing a beat, he said to me, "Oh, no, Mr. Cleese, I spill very little when I'm driving." I mean, that was just wonderful.
Something that I see, you've made a documentary as well, which we'll come to in a minute, but something I noticed about it, you've been reflecting a lot on the importance of laughter and the healing power of laughter as you get older, haven't you?
That's right. And it started when I was in Sarajevo, and they'd had a terrible time during the early 90s when Yugoslavia was breaking up. And, there were atrocities going on. And they were in Sarajevo, they were surrounded by the Serbs up in the hills for 4 years. And I said, "Well, how do you deal with that?" And they said, "We got an underground car park, turned it into a cinema, and we used to go there after dark when it was safe to cross the streets and watch comedy. A lot of it, I was proud to say, was Monty Python." And I said, and they said, "Well, we just felt better when we came out." And I said, "But nothing changed." They said, "No, it hadn't, but somehow we could cope with it better." And then when I started doing Comic Cons, people said to me, so many people said to me, "Thank you for helping me through difficult times." Now, you don't expect, a comedian does not expect people to say that, but so many people said it. I suddenly realized that if they could laugh, they could handle nasty, uncomfortable, unhappy situations better than if they took them entirely seriously, and that they would quite deliberately put on an episode of Faulty Task and watch it. And at the end of it, they felt a bit better.
It changes the body as well. Laughter is such a physical act that it does actually, you know, now we all know that trauma and all these things are in the body and everything. Come here, has it made you happy in your life, making people laugh?
Oh, yes, I love it. What I don't like is the travel. You see, I don't do much television now because I don't understand television. And I have to say, I don't think the BBC know how to do it anymore. So there's not very much good comedy out there. There's a lot of talent, but there's a sort of administrative setup that does not know how to make that talent work.
I suppose we have to also accept that, you know, we all have our time as well, and that things change, and, you know.
Yeah, that's right. And you really need to be frightened of dying. And I think it all depends on whether you think there's an afterlife. And I've been interested in this for 20, 30 years. I think that something happens when we die. I don't think that's the end of it.
What do you think it might be?
I don't know. That's the hard bit. But if you read all the evidence, you come to the conclusion that that's the best explanation for a lot of the very strange things that happen. I mean, these NDEs, I mean, here's an NDE experience. Somebody had an NDE experience.
This is a near-death experience, yeah.
Near-death experience and got to the end and was being greeted by everyone before he was told you had to go back. And he saw someone there and he thought, well, why are they there? They're alive. And when he got back into his body and checked that, no, that person had died, but he hadn't found out. So how do you all the people who died were there waiting to greet him, including this one guy? I mean,
I think the question could be that, are we not all living through a near-death experience called life?
Yeah, that's right. And now that I'm 86, if you can believe that, I find myself thinking about death, but not as something very threatening. It's more two things. One is I'm having a good time, and the longer that goes on, the better. But when I die, I think it gets even more interesting. And I think if I'm on my deathbed, I will be able to say to myself, I wonder what happens now. And that's okay. Better than thinking, you know, goodbye world forever.
Yeah, well, I suppose, look, whatever's helpful to think. How long do you think you've left?
I think I'm just about to take several months off to get my health back because the travelling that I do a lot of shows. It's the easiest way to earn money, but the travel kills you. So I'm going to have a 2 or 3 months off. My wife and I are going to go to Thailand. It'll be warm. We can swim 2 or 3 times and just get my fitness back because my health is very good. I have what they call a bodily age of 69, which is very good, but it won't be very good until I start taking exercise. But Steve Martin put it very funnily. He said about touring, he said, I do the shows for free, but they pay me for travel. That's my attitude towards it. I thoroughly enjoy going on stage, but getting in a bus the next day and traveling for 5 hours on bad roads in America is no fun.
Yeah, yeah. And the new documentary, John Cleese Packs It In, follows you on tour. And I can see that, you know, I can see that the travel, you try and be cheerful about it and everything, but it is a drudge. And then you come on stage and if you don't mind me saying, it's like 20 years falls off you, isn't it?
Well, it's a great feeling, you see, because the lovely thing about the stage shows is that people don't come if they don't like you. They don't say, I can't stand him, let's buy 6 tickets. So they're pre-selected to like you. And as you walk out,
excellent.
On stage,
yeah.
There's this wall of affection, because if you make people laugh, they feel affection. Wall of affection hits me and makes me feel very good.
Yeah. You blame your ex-wife for the fact that you're still touring. Would you explain that?
Sure. I had a reasonable amount of money saved, not the sort of sums you would have expected if I'd been an American, but I had a very nice amount of money put aside. And then when I was 70, I got a divorce. I should have got it many years before. And the Californian legal system operated in such a way that I had to give her $20 million, although we'd
never
had...
So does that imply you had $40 million?
No.
You're giving her half it?
No, that's an extraordinary thing. I had $20 million. So I got back to England and I said, well, what's the position? And they said, well, you've got to pay her $1 million a year. And I said, yes, I know. But they said, the problem is now you're back in England. You have to earn $2 million and then you pay half of that in tax and you give her the other half. And I couldn't believe this. I said, you mean I've got to earn $2 million before I get to keep a penny? And they said, I'm afraid so. I had a bit of a laugh about that because it was so ridiculous.
Yeah, you had a bit of a laugh and then you had a very bad breakdown, didn't you?
I had a breakdown because we moved to Monaco to try and get around some of the tax problems until, you know, that was sorted. Yeah. And then I just became very depressed. There was a very bad winter and very cold, and my wife was visiting me most of the time. But it just ground me down. And suddenly, my wife came back and she called a psychiatrist, and he came out from London and said, "You have to come back and." And I hadn't realized how depressed I was, but I was in a place for about two and a half months, I think. There was snow on the ground, but they just looked after me, and there was no stress because everyone kept that away. And I started slowly feeling better and better. And I don't regret the experience, oddly enough, because it was scary at the time sometimes, you know, thoughts, not very serious ones of suicide. But what happened was that I discovered that my value system changed, I think, in a useful way, because you start thinking about what really matters.
And what really matters?
I suppose it boils down to love. And yeah. I've been really lucky. On my fourth marriage, I've been with someone, and it's a really good marriage, and it's the most important thing in the world.
Before we come back to that, can I just ask you one other thing about the breakdown? Mm-hmm. Had you been depressed at other points in your life, the way a lot of comedians do seem to have?
I didn't live with depression like a lot of comedians did, but I know when I broke up with Connie, because she initiated the breakup, I think I was depressed for about 2 years at that point. But after that, no, I think I had depressive issues, but I was handling them in the way most people do, by remaining slightly manic and always keeping busy.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And now I don't have any of that at all. I just have I just want to try and get everything done, and I can start. I would like to do some television programs about life after death, and that I think
is that a big interest now? Yeah.
Oh yes, and you know, talk to nurses, talk to people who are there at the moment the people die.
Yeah, okay.
And strange things they see, because if you said to me, "What's the most important thing in life?" and apart from my wife and cats,
yeah,
I have to say it's really a sense of meaning. To have a sense of meaning, and the idea that we go on after this life is terribly interesting. You know, what's going to happen? Who's up there? Do I get to meet Nehru or Stalin?
Okay. You see, I think people might be surprised at what a thoughtful person you are. But then I think you mentioned it in the documentary that you're actually an introvert.
Oh, yes.
Which will surprise people. So did you have to strain all those years to be that kind of extrovert character you were?
No, there were lots and lots and lots of actors who were extroverts. And there's two things. One is that they play characters that are not really themselves. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah.
And the other thing is that that introverts get energy from being on their own or being with people they love, and they tend to get tired by crowds. So when I come off stage, although I often feel quite exhilarated, as the adrenaline drops after 15 minutes, I sometimes feel very, very tired physically. But oddly enough, I never felt it when I was out there. And then I rest and then I get my energy back. But you see, extroverts love to be around people and they get energy from people. And what they're frightened of is boredom. Whereas introverts have a lot going on in their mind. And what they're frightened of is overload, is feeling overwhelmed by too much stimulation. And that's why we instinctively don't like each other. Well, there's a sort of pitying attitude. The introverts looking at the extroverts thinking, poor, simple creatures, provided they're running around and preferably hitting people, they're perfectly happy.
Yeah, and loud and superficial and, yeah.
Oh,
you make the sorties out into the crowd, so to speak, and then back in to recharge the batteries. And I sense that you've said your current marriage is very happy.
Yes.
And your wife features a bit in the documentary. Is the secret that you make each other laugh?
It's, well, that's part of it. I mean, she's just extraordinarily funny. On Wednesday night, I went out to dinner with, nobody else knows this, I went out to dinner with a couple, Matthew Side, actually, who writes for the Sunday Times, and his wife, Kathy. And when I arrived, I was taken down a corridor. And when I came out the other end of the corridor, there were 70 people, or I should say 70 lemurs, looking at me, because it was a surprise party and they all had lemur masks.
No way.
I walked into the room and there were 60, 70 people of my oldest friends all wearing lemur masks. And I think if I'm, when I'm on my deathbed, I'm going to recall those lemur masks and think,
fantastic. And yeah. What was it in aid of?
She came up with an excuse, 60 years in show business, which is more or less
excellent. Name drop a bit. Who was there?
Rowan Atkinson and Terry Gilliam and Holly Gilliam, who's Terry's daughter, who manages Python now and is lovely, and Alison Steadman. All my good friends over there. I mean, Alison Steadman's been my wife twice on television. And I thought to myself, you know, I think we should do a third one. I think we should do a series of terrible, awful, very old people. And she laughed when I suggested that. So I'm going to think about it this morning. But it was and someone, Matthew Said, said afterwards, he said, all your friends are very nice people. And it's true. My friends are very, very nice people. And they always like each other, even if they've never met before. But it was
extraordinary. And are all the showbiz people and the comics trying to outdo each other with, you know, jokes and everything like that? Is it that kind of environment, or have you all mellowed a bit now?
Nothing as vulgar as that, Brendan. No. I get on the phone with Michael Palin, and then we always finish up screaming with laughter because we make each other laugh, but there's nothing... what's the word, planned about it? No, it's and my point was that my wife had organised all of that, including the lemur masks, without my having the slightest idea that was what she was up to. And that's what she's like. It's a lot of people.
Do you think Fawlty Towers would be made now? Did people find some of it offensive at the time? Or, you know, I suppose I'm thinking about the Germans and that, or... Did it pass without remark then? Would it happen now?
It totally passed without, because that's not how people thought in the 70s. People, if they were offended in the 70s because somebody said the F word, that would stop the traffic, you see. You can say it now. Nobody even notices it. There's another word, the N word. If you say that, that stops the traffic. Then probably be another word in 20 years' time, and that'll stop the traffic. No, it was very relaxed. We very seldom got into any kind of problem. Sometimes people complained a bit about Monty Python, but that was because we used to go out late on a Sunday night. We didn't have a very big audience. And if somebody registered a complaint at the BBC, we might be told about it, but we never took it that seriously because you know that whatever you do is going to offend someone. I mean, you can't avoid it except by doing something that's completely bland.
Yeah.
If you do something that is of no interest at all and totally predictable, then you don't get complaints. Well, that's not the business I want to be in.
And do you think, is that the business for a lot of people now? I know you, kind of a few years ago, I think, you got this name of being, I won't say a crank, but this kind of anti-woke, old-fashioned kind of...
Two different things. I got a bad reputation with the press because I was so appalled at the low moral standards of the British press, and I spoke out about it. And if you do that, they don't do anything about improving their moral standards. They simply try and paint a very, very unattractive picture of you.
Okay.
And that's what they did. I've forgotten. I was going to say something else, but I've forgotten it.
About the wokeness? You're saying they were two different things.
Oh, the woke stuff. The trouble about woke is there's a long spectrum of things. From one end, being inclusive and kind and helping people with difficulties, I mean, who's going to disagree with that? That was around before woke. You know, there was a guy called Jesus Christ who had ideas like that 2,000 years ago. He wasn't considered a revolutionary. But the trouble is that there's another end of woke, which is very unscrupulous and dishonest and very punishing and very negative, like this idea about microaggressions. Do you know that they can teach you to spot a microaggression which otherwise you wouldn't have noticed? Otherwise, you'd go on with your life, but if you wanted to, you could learn how to spot a microaggression, upset about it, and after you got upset about it and got sort of generally less happy, you could then try and get somebody fired for, and it's ridiculous. One of the things was mispronouncing your name. Somebody mispronounced, that was a microaggression. Well, ever since I'd gone to America in 1964, they pronounced my name wrong. They call me Cleese. And I say to them, do you ever go to a supermarket to buy cheddar cheese? The name is Cleese. But I've had 60 years of people mispronouncing my name, and I haven't had to go in a nursing home yet.
Okay.
One end of woke is very good. The other is very silly and quite dangerous.
Look, I guess it you'd agree as well. It can come down to how a person mispronounces your name and who you are and what power you have in the situation and all that too, doesn't it?
Are you
laughing at me, John Cleese?
No, I'm just laughing at the whole idea because, you know, my dad changed my name. My dad was born Reginald Cheese, and he changed it when he went in the First World War. But it's just people get upset about things that don't matter. And as a philosophy, I like Stoicism. Stoicism is sort of basically saying don't try and control things you can't control.
Yeah.
And just worry about the things you can control. And I think it's a very intelligent philosophy, and it's a complete opposite, the exact polar opposite of everything that the extreme woke people are on about. And if anybody ever wanted to arrange for me to have a friendly debate with people on television, I would do it. But, you know, I had a television show briefly for, what are they called?
GB News, yeah.
And I did that because they said I could do anything I wanted. And I had a program about woke, and I tried to get people on to talk about it. And one of the women who is a proponent of woke said the very fact that you're having to discuss it is the problem. It should just be accepted. In other words, if you don't agree with us, you're a bad person, and we will try and make your life more difficult. So agree with us.
So looking back over everything, Monty Python, Fawlty Towers, to being in James Bond films, Harry Potter films, Shrek, A Fish Called Wanda, Clockwise, what are you most proud of?
Life of Brian. I think that was the best. Fawlty Towers, certainly. Wanda, I think, was very good. And I wrote a little book about creativity, which can be read in an hour. And I think it's very important, and I like to tell people about it.
Oh, yeah? What's it called?
It's called Creativity, which is not a very creative title, but at least you can remember it. And it's about when I discovered, being very left-brain, getting into Cambridge on science and then switching to law, it was when I discovered that I was a bit creative, and what I discovered about creativity, which is that your mind will work on problems when your conscious mind is not thinking about them. Mm. And things like that. And if you can learn to use your unconscious mind in a very helpful way, and people need to know this, but it's never taught in schools.
Yeah, agreed. Any big regrets?
Third marriage?
Yeah.
I think Bristol City got in a very, very promising position once, and that rather faded away. That was the first team I ever supported. So
okay.
I say Bristol City's been a bit of a disappointment.
I asked you there, are you happy now in your mid-80s at how it's all turned out? You do seem happy in yourself, are you?
Yes, I think I've been quite happy, quite. I never really felt that this was what I should be doing. I mean, I knew I was good at it, and I knew it gave a lot of pleasure, but there were a lot of other things that seemed to me more important, like, is there an afterlife? And most of my life, I've worked too hard. And writing the 40 Towers book, I realized there are all these lovely people, and I didn't spend enough time with them because I was always working.
Hmm. There's a lesson there. By the way, are you comfortable financially now?
Yes.
Good. I'm glad to hear it. You deserve to be.
After about 15 years, I'm now comfortable. And so my wife and I are going to take off several months to get my health back, because my health's good, but it'd get my fitness back because I'm overweight. And I've got vertigo, and I'm trying to want to get rid of that. And I also had a problem with my foot. I had an operation to remove a bone spur. And if you can believe this, Brendan, it's taken me 6 years to heal it.
I can believe it because I've seen the pictures in the documentary. It's absolutely revolting. I don't know how you live with that creature on the end of your toe. So, John, we end as we began with the organ recital. We've come full circle.
Quite right. Well, now, almost everything important is fixed. So if I can, I think that if I can get reasonably fit and avoid work for a few months, which I can do now, I think I might be able to go on for at least another 6 or 7 years doing some funny stuff, like a stage version of Life of Brian, which I've written.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah.
I'm going to direct. And then a stage version of a musical of A Fish Called Wanda. And then I agreed last night with a friend to write a book together about literal mindedness, which interests me enormously. So there's plenty of things I want to do, but I don't want to do much traveling in buses anymore.
Okay. Well, look, I hope when you have another project that you'll come back and talk to us, because it's been a real pleasure. And maybe next time you might come here if the toe and the vertigo allows it. Maybe you'd come in and join us.
If there's any way of driving to Ireland in a nice car, I'll be coming.
I'll come and get you myself, John Cleese. Okay, Fawlty Towers, Faults and All is the book. It's out now, published by Headline. And the documentary is in cinemas now. It's called John Cleese Packs It In. John, the best of luck with your trip to Thailand and getting your health back and everything. But you certainly didn't seem unhealthy today. You're on fire still, and it's great to hear it.
If I die soon, then you can interview me about what happens afterwards.
If you die soon, this interview will go viral worldwide, his final interview. Not that I'm hoping for that to happen. Let's make the next one the last one, okay?
All right. It's been a great pleasure, Steve.
you have to do that before the end, didn't you? Thank you, John Cleese.
Great pleasure. Have a good day.
Yeah, bye. You too.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.